Disclaimer, this content is meant for information only and not as a diagnosis or medical treatment for any condition. If you or a loved one needs help, please seek out a qualified medical professional for assistance. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Katie Oshta, BSN, RN, IBCLC, and Infant Feeding Specialist. Quench your thirst for knowledge and travel with me across the nation to discover, learn, collaborate, and better serve clients from all over the globe. Let's ride and thrive together. Thanks for listening to the podcast today. Today, I don't have a guest. I wanted to talk about kind of how we think about things. So I am in an amazing residency program. It is Holistic Lactation course taught by Jennifer Toe, who is my mentor in this class, is a year-long residency program culminating with a week in person in Connecticut. I am in the 8th cohort that she has done with typically people from all over the world. There was even one cohort in 2017, I believe, that was based in UAE and all international providers. It's more than just a course. It is a really a reframing and a look at holistic modalities and what supporting the dyad is supposed to mean and be. So it's really much more than just tongue tie or milk supply or even getting baby back to the breast, which is a biological norm, but it's really understanding how the dyad works, how this stuff is supposed to go together, all of this. And it's so different than what we're typically taught. There is a base level of knowledge expected in the course. We have to have already taken the IBCLC master class and have a, you know, pretty deep understanding of tongue tie so that that gets us all to the same place. But so far, our lectures have been, let's see, let me pull out my stuff. We have had self-care modalities, right? We have had really kind of trying to understand the dyad. We've had mother's milk and supply and kind of hormone stuff. We've had alternative things such as Bach flowers and homeopathy started. We'll be learning more about the lactogenic diet and, you know, deeper dive into gut health, which let me tell you, I've already taken Jennifer's course on gut health, and that's a pretty deep dive to begin with. But one of the other things she talks about is framework and how we see things, you know, what we consider normal. I always say, though, we've confused the words common and normal, and that more often it's what we see that's common, not what we see that's normal, because frequently I feel like our society has lost the norm, which I'll talk about more. But let me just start with, so kind of understanding where our frame is, because everyone has a different one, right? We all come from different beginnings and lots of different experiences and education and life, right? What we're exposed to, what we're not. So it's really important, just like understanding your bias, understanding your framework really matters. What do you think of as normal? What do you think of as common, right? What is acceptable to you? So I want to start with something that we think of as fairly benign, right? Tylenol or acetaminophen, or depending upon where you're in the world, paracetamol, I think. It is a lot of times in the US thought of as very benign, right? It is just a basic thing that anybody can have it. When I worked in labor and delivery, which was from 2000 to 2014, I was a labor and delivery nurse. That was basic. Everyone got Tylenol. Let me tell you, anyone came in for any reason when they were pregnant, we handed out Tylenol like it was candy, because there were so many things that we didn't want them to take. And we said, Tylenol is basic. It's there's no risk, which is not true. And I think that we need to also understand that any pharmaceutical has risk. Any synthetic substance has risk. Even a synthetic vitamin or supplement is synthetic, is not the same thing as natural. And there are natural things with risks, right? There are natural things that can be harmful. So it's really important to understand pros and cons and risk and benefit and all of that. But let's go back to the Tylenol, right? We are understanding, or common, I'd say overall, I mean, I see new parents all the time. It's commonly thought of as totally benign. It doesn't matter. They can give the baby Tylenol kind of whenever. There's no risk. But I think that it's really important that we do a little bit of a deep dive here. And really ask ourselves, why do we consider this benign? Why do we say that this is totally safe? Because it's not. In recent years, we have stuff showing that more Tylenol use is linked to bone fractures in children, that we're not getting the same bone density that we are in children when not taking acetaminophen. And then we have other risks as asthma and eczema, right? ADHD when taken significantly during pregnancy, and that it causes brain inflammation during those critical growing years. There's also significant evidence that Tylenol is no longer considered a pain reliever. Actually, in 2015, the FDA made makers of acetaminophen take pain reliever off the label. It cannot say it's a pain reliever for children anymore because it does not actually relieve pain. In every study, again and again, it's been shown that it does not relieve pain. There is evidence to show that it does reduce a fever. Now, whether or not that's a good thing, that's a whole other discussion. But there is plenty of evidence to show it does not reduce pain in children under two. So much, in fact, that the FDA, like I said, made the manufacturers of acetaminophen remove pain reliever from the label. So now it says a great fever reducer, right? But it cannot say pain reliever. And I think it's really important that we pause and think about that, right? And think about everything we're giving does have an effect, pros and cons, right? But this is where that framework comes in. This is where I just want to challenge people to think about, what do you think of as normal? What do you think of as having, quote unquote, no risk? Because I think it's really important to acknowledge that most things have risk. I'll say to clients, this might have no known risk, right? For example, I will use homeopathy with clients or slippery elm for reflux. Slippery elm has no known risks. It is the bark of a slippery elm tree and we know nothing negative from it. That doesn't mean that we can't find that in 10 years, right? It doesn't mean there really isn't risk. It just means we don't know about it. But I think it's important how we frame that and how we say it and think about it. You know, medication safety is such a big deal. And part of why it's a big deal is because of how much medication is used in this country. So in the US, the most common prescribed class of drugs by age are, for 0 to 11 years old, bronchodilators, right? So what does that mean? Albuterol, right? Number one. So for asthma, for pneumonia, for bronchitis, these are huge. That is the number one class of drugs for children, 0 to 11. 12 to 19. You want to guess here? Unfortunately, this is stimulants. At an age when their brain is growing and they are not fully formed adults, when they cannot make decisions and have full frontal lobe cortex development, the most common class of drugs is stimulants. Things like Ritalin, Adderall, right? And 20 to 59, not shocking, especially in this day and age of post-COVID world, antidepressants. Because antidepressants are currently the answer for everything, which is really unfortunate. I mean, I'm never saying that you should or should not take a medication. What I'm saying is that we need to be taking a closer look at it and really looking at the risk benefit. It still might be the right thing for you, but we need to know what the cost is. And age 60 and up, it's statins, which have not been shown to reduce heart attacks, have not been shown to reduce morbidity and mortality from heart attacks. And yet there are cardiologists out there that want to see every, you know, 50 or 60 year old in the country on statins, even though they're not shown to work. Even though we still have the same number of heart attacks, the same number of deaths, we're not making a difference. And yet there are billions of people on statins. Sorry, millions. It is scary, the amount. So there are millions of people out there on PPIs, which is a protein pump inhibitor, right? Like Pepcid, Zantac, those were approved for 6 weeks of use. There are people out there on them for decades, decades, that they are decreasing the gastric and the stomach acid, which makes it harder for them to digest and absorb their food, makes it harder to get nutrients out of their food. So I also just want to talk briefly about how many prescriptions. So this is my framework, right? I live in the US. I work in the US. I'm both a consumer and a practitioner of healthcare. There are 6.7 billion, with a B, billion prescriptions were written in 2022 in the US alone for 331 million people, which comes out to around 20 prescriptions per person per year. That's an awful lot of prescriptions, people. How did we get to this place? How did we go so far from herbal and natural medicine, from alternative, I hate using alternative therapies like acupuncture and chiropractic as alternative when they were there first, right? The Western allopathic model is the alternative to natural medicine, which has been our heritage. All people started, all cultures started with the natural medicine, not with prescriptions, right? Why did we stop turning to food? Why did we stop using food and nature to heal us? Why is our culture so comfortable with the idea of a pill fixing all of our problems that they don't want to look past it? Okay. And it's just astounding to me how many prescriptions are written every year. And even assuming that maybe not all of those are filled or taken, that's a lot of prescriptions. We're talking 20 prescriptions per person for a year. And if you're someone who maybe doesn't do a lot, I know I'm a family of four here. None of us, I'm the only one who's had a prescription in this family in the last couple of years. So, you know, where are 20 going? Who's ending up with all of those? You know, it's astounding. And I think we have this, again, that framework, that idea that our physicians kind of know everything, that they know all the things. And with that, I want to talk about how new developments become part of medicine, right? So every year, there are 300,000 to 400,000 studies published in the US, between 900 and 1 million studies published worldwide, okay? So even if we're talking about those US studies, even if we're not looking worldwide, which we should be, even if we're talking 300,000 to 400,000 studies a year, even if we narrow it down to, you know, what type of medicine your provider does or whatever, there are so many studies, it's impossible for them to stay up on it. Impossible, right? So they cannot possibly know about all the studies. And very few of those studies become widely known and become shared with that knowledge being widely spread. You know, if when I was talking about the acetaminophen, the other thing I forgot to bring up is I was looking at acetaminophen studies, and one of them came up linking it with autism. And autism is a hot button, okay? It's not in my scope. I don't work with autistic kids. I have no experience with it, and I don't have a whole lot of background education on it. So I will say that right away, okay? This is not my space, really. So I was looking at it with a lens of very much someone new learning about it. And in, you know, I think that there's been a decent amount of evidence to show that autism, while it has some sort of link with vaccines, does not seem caused by vaccines. Well, then I came across some interesting studies showing that in 1982 and in 1986, there were significant decreases in autism cases. And what's significant about that is in 1982 and 1986, there were issues with acetaminophen or Tylenol tampering, and Tylenol usage went significantly down. People either, parents either used ibuprofen depending upon the age of the child, or they did not medicate post-vaccine, and the autism cases dropped. And this study compared vaccines given with ibuprofen as opposed to vaccines given with acetaminophen. And there is a definite link between autism and the MMR vaccine given at 12 and 18 months when treated with acetaminophen. That study is, what are we talking, 40 years old? This information is 40 years old. Why is that not more talked about, right? Why is there so much gatekeeping in medicine? Maybe someone would say that, you know, this hasn't been totally proven. They don't want to alarm parents. They don't want to, you know, decrease the number of parents getting vaccines because vaccines are important, whatever. I think it's really a very delicate line. And I think that line is almost insignificant, really. You do not have the right as a provider to decide what information gets shared with the patient. We do not. I do not decide to tell my parents that I see my clients about one study about tongue tie and not another. I don't. I don't have the right to do that. I need to present the information and let them make a decision. I don't present only positive tongue tie studies. I present negative as well. I present studies and I will talk about, okay, let's go through. Let's look at the study. Was it a study with 100 kids or was it a retrospective study on one, right? Like, let's look at it and let's analyze. But I don't have the right to withhold information and no provider does. And that's what gatekeeping is. And unfortunately, in medicine, a lot of things are not presented and the information is not given because of various reasons of, hey, we don't want to worry the parents. You don't want to overwhelm them. This isn't totally proven. I don't care if it's proven or not. If there is a possibility that the MMR vaccine at 12 and 18 months given with acetaminophen as opposed to ibuprofen could be linked with autism, well, then why would I not want that information? So as a parent, I could give my child ibuprofen if I was choosing to vaccinate, right? Why would we not want to share that? There are plenty of things in medicine that we do not know are 100%. There are plenty of times that we do not have absolute cause and effect. It takes a long time to get there. Lots of double-blind, randomized, controlled studies. And guess what? Those are really hard to do with pregnancy, lactation, and pediatrics. It is really hard to get those studies approved by an IRB board and do all of that. It's just the ethics of it alone when you're talking about withholding something that you can show you really think is going to be beneficial and withholding it so that that group doesn't get it to have that double-blind study. It's very hard. So we don't have good studies, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't share what we have. And it doesn't invalidate the smaller studies that we do have. Just because they're not double-blind, random controlled studies does not invalidate them. There are 5 different levels of evidence, and it does not have to be level 5 to qualify as evidence. So we need to stop gatekeeping as providers, right? There needs to be more information shared so that the parents can make the decision that is best for them. Okay. For example, with medications, I will talk to parents about the fact that there is risk putting a baby on a PPI for putting them on Pepcid for reflux, right? There is risk in that. And if the parents feel that it's the right decision for their baby, then I'll talk to them about how can I support you through this? Let's look at what that medication depletes, because let's be clear, every pharmaceutical depletes something in our body. And let's work to replenish that, right? Let's work to help and make it work better. So it does not have to be an either or. Parents can choose what is best for their family. I'm never going to tell a parent what to do. It's just not how I work in my practice. I present the information and I will give my professional opinion, of course, but I'm always going to tell the parents that it is what they think is right that matters. It is what they think is best and that they can do their own research as well. That I welcome other points of view. I do not want to operate in a vacuum. Part of why I podcast is to learn from other providers. You know, just this morning, I was recording with Dr. Ashley Rich, and I want to hear from other people. I want to learn from a chiropractor, right? I want to learn from a myofascial release therapist. I want to learn about cranial sacral and dentists who do releases and OTs and SLPs. Like, I want to understand how it looks from a different side. And if we're all communicating better, we're going to have a wider framework. And that's the problem really with our frames, is that they're too narrow. Okay. We overall, as a society, as a culture, and as professionals, get into narrow frames. And that means that we're not looking at all the information. We're not sharing all the information because, for starters, we don't have it. Honestly, we don't. And it's worrisome. I think that it's really important that we start questioning why on a lot more things. For example, this came up the other day, and it's interesting to me the things that I never thought about, that I always just went along with and assumed that everything with that was perfectly normal, acceptable, fine, no risk, whatever, however you want to say it. Well, it was brought to my attention and shared, some information was shared with me about vitamin K, right? Something that we, in the US, every baby gets vitamin K, or every baby is supposed to get vitamin K in a hospital, right? So everything is required. And you have to sign paperwork if you don't want your baby to get it. And then a lot of times a physician will come in and try to push you and say, yes, this is rare, but it's a deadly clotting disorder. And if you don't do this, your baby could die before you could even get help, right?
It's,
which I'm not exaggerating. I have heard many a times, both from clients, but also I've witnessed myself, pediatricians say that, and even nurses and OBs, other people say it to the families and say, if you don't do this, your baby could die and you need it right now. Why don't we stop and question why? So here's the thing about humans. We've been around a really long time. And for most of that time, we didn't have pharmaceuticals. We didn't have vitamin K shots. And yes, there were things that we can treat now that we couldn't. I mean, look at something such as like leprosy, something that such as antibiotic can treat so simply that could be a debilitating disease and could cause death, right? So I'm not saying that pharmaceuticals are bad, but I think that when we blanket, when we say that all babies, all adults, all people need this, I really am starting to question that and wonder, how is that possible? How is it possible that all babies are deficient in vitamin K? So let's think about that. What does vitamin K do? Even vitamin K is a clotting factor, so it's going to thicken a baby's blood. And you might wonder, well, why would the baby have thinner blood, or why would the baby need a thickener, right? And so if you go down that little rabbit hole, you can look at the fact that babies are being squeezed typically through a birth canal, right? Their skull bones are moving, there's inflammation, and there's a lot of trauma that happens. Well, in the cord blood, there is also stem cells. And then in the breast milk, they get stem cells. This is also why cord blood is meant to drain to the baby until it stops pulsating, not a quote unquote delayed cord clamping at a minute. It's supposed to just be able to finish its transfer. But it's just so interesting to me because part of birth is trauma. Okay. And these, as far as we're understanding now, the babies have thinner blood for a reason, to bring those stem cells up to that brain that just had a bunch of trauma, right? To that inflammation, and bring it up there easily, right? Not walking up through sludge of thick, thick blood that just got shot with vitamin K, because now that vitamin K is hundreds and hundreds of percents higher than their clotting factors should be, massively high. So now instead of a normal, even human, even adult thickness of blood, it's way thicker than that, right? So we've got this really babies that are designed to have the system where they do have a thinner blood system. And then we come in and say, nope, that's not right. Let's make it as thick as possible. So now we slow everything down and those stem cells can't get to where they need to go. I think that what I'm realizing my frame was, is that it seems like we've forgotten that everything was designed by nature. There is a reason for everything. Yes, even an appendix, right? There is a reason for everything, and everything in our body has many purposes. Everything does so many things. There is a reason babies are born with thinner blood and they don't need vitamin K to thicken it up. It thickens on its own when it's ready. Nature had all of this planned out, right? And I think we've lost sight of that remembrance that this is a planned system. You know, for example, with feeding, we have this whole mentality that, you know, moms need to latch the baby on and put the baby on the breast and do all this stuff. We've completely forgotten that babies are born with feeding reflexes. All mammal babies go to the breast. They do not need someone to put them on. So how is this? How did we get here, right? How did we stop listening to natural and herbal medicine? How did we walk away from our history that we had been there for hundreds or thousands of years? You know, a lot of medicine women in different cultures were typically women, right? But how did we walk away from all of that? So my challenge to you today as a listener and a provider, and even as a consumer of healthcare, because we all have our own health needs as well, is to ask yourself, what's your framework? What are things that you accept as normal without even questioning? Like I said, I accepted vitamin K as normal until I started doing a deeper dive into it and looking at it and really kind of challenging myself to question, why? Wait a second, why would every baby need this? And there are obviously places in the world, many of them, in fact, where vitamin K isn't given. Are their babies dying at massively higher rates than ours? Nope, not at all. So I challenge you to think about it. I challenge you to ask yourself, what are the things that you think about and accept as normal? What are the things that you assume are benign or common and everyday normal things that don't need to be examined, and why, right? I think it's really important to consider those things and to have a good look at our framework and to say to yourself, is that what you want to be your framework? Because for me, this has been an eye-opening. I've realized there are things that were in my frame was limiting, right? I had too many things that I was accepting. And I'm not saying that you should discount everything, but a little curiosity goes a long way. So I challenge you to expand your frame, first to look at it and to figure out where it is, and then to think about expanding it. Push those boundaries a little. Ask more questions. Be curious and really stop accepting things as status quo. So let me know if you do it. I would love to hear from you. I'll post some of this on Instagram and on my website. And I'd love to hear what you think about your own framework and what it means for your practice and what it would look like if you opened those doors a little and let more in. Be curious, okay? Ask why. Thank you for listening.
When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change you. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast today and learned something new. If you know someone who would benefit from this podcast, please share.